We are a multicultural society. And why aren't our stages looking like the communities we live in? I think opera is one of the slowest moving industries as far as diversity, equity, and inclusion go. And so I said, it's time to go. Let's start speaking up about these inequities.
You're listening to the Mother of Reinvention Show, a weekly podcast about midlife motherhood, careers, health, relationships, and more. I'm Megan Francis, a 40-something mom of 5 kids ages teen to young adult. Listen each Thursday as I bring you an interview with an inspiring mother of reinvention, plus some of my thoughts about wellness, self-care, relationships and divorce, big kid parenting, and more. It's all at motherofreinventionshow.com. Keep listening for another episode of the Mother of Reinvention Show. It's what's next for midlife moms. Is Nina Yoshida Nelson singing an aria from Carmen with Josh Quinn on the piano. As an amateur performer, I've always been fascinated by people who make a living from their art. And as a mom, I'm even more fascinated by other mothers who manage a career as a traveling performer. Today's guest, Nina Yoshida Nelson, does both. Nina's career as an opera singer started when a voice teacher convinced her to go to one audition, even though Nina thought she hated opera. She got in, got a scholarship, and decided to give opera a shot, and then fell in love with this art form. In this episode, Nina and I talk about what it was like for her to perform in touring productions when her kids were really little, what it's like now that they're 11 and 6, and what she sees as her future in opera. We also talk about how the opera community is trying to reach younger audiences, and how Nina herself is spearheading efforts to bring more racial diversity to the stage after finding herself facing a lot of typecasting as an Asian American singer. This was an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I learned a lot about opera and what it really means to be inclusive in the arts. We'll get to that conversation in just a minute, but first I want to remind you about a special page I have set up where I share some of my favorite things. It's at morefaves.com. That's M-O-R, faves, F-A-V-E-S.com. I share products and other things I'm loving right now, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. A little while ago, I did a roundup of some of my favorite black teas with discount codes, so maybe you can share a cup of tea with me at a great deal. Again, that's at morefaves.com, M-O-R-faves.com. Okay, now let's jump into my conversation with professional opera singer Nina Yoshida Nelson. Hi, Nina. Thank you so much for being on the show.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. This is really exciting. You are the first opera singer I have interviewed for this show, so that's very special.
Hey. I'm usually the first opera singer most people meet, actually. I used to sing in high school choir, but my big focus when I was younger was as a violinist. And so I went to college and studied violin and psychology and thought that eventually what I wanted to do is help people with performance anxiety. And so I got into a master's degree to do just that. And I had just started taking voice lessons and my voice teacher said, "Don't you want to think about maybe pursuing opera?" And I was like, "No, I hate opera. It's so pretentious. I hate opera singers." And somehow she convinced me to just audition for one school. And so I auditioned and I got in and I got a big scholarship. And I thought, well, I mean, like I can always go back and do psychology later, but I don't know that I could ever go back and do opera again. And then once I was on stage, I was just hooked and I couldn't stop. So,
wow. Okay. What hooked you? What really got you?
So the first opera I ever did was comedy, and just the feeling of being on stage and having an audience laugh as I would do something and what it felt like with that give and take of energy. It was just so thrilling to realize that I could help entertain and bring joy to other people that I was like, yeah, this is what I'm meant to do.
Yeah. My uncle, when I was growing up, worked at the Lyric Opera in Chicago. And I remember, like, on the weekends, he would watch 4 and 6 hour long videos of opera. And I always tried to get it. I remember thinking, like, something is lost in the translation here. But if I really understood what was happening, I think I could love this. It's very theatrical, but it's also amazing performance quality. And so I could see how that could really hook you and that connection with the audience, because people who love opera, like, really, really love opera.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. I think that, like, when you meet a bunch of people who haven't seen opera and you tell them, like, if you go to a live show, there will be super titles. So you're not going to be just listening to Italian and not understanding what's happening, but you'll actually be able to read along. And oftentimes people have no idea that that's the case, that, like, yes, you can go to an opera and you can understand everything that's happening. And so, you know, you think of opera as this, like, big thing that that's just so overwhelming. And it'll be, like you said, 4 or 6 hours long. But, you know, it's also called the quote unquote, like, complete art form, because you've got theater, you've got singing, you've got music, you've got costumes and makeup and scenery and everything. And you've got all of the arts combined into one in opera.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's definitely going to be an experience. Do you find that younger audiences are they still interested? Are they engaged? Is that an issue?
Yeah, so, you know, this is one thing that we're talking about all the time, is how do we engage younger audiences? And one of the things that has happened in the last 10 or so years is that operas are being written that are shorter and more accessible and more interesting, maybe to a younger crowd. For example, I do an opera, actually one that I've done at Lyric in Chicago, called American Dream. And it centers around a Japanese-American family who's incarcerated during World War II. And so it's about 75 minutes long, and it centers around, you know, things that younger audiences are interested in watching and learning about. And it's at those shows that you do find a lot of the younger crowd coming and seeing their first opera.
Yeah. Wow. I also noticed my local movie theater, every now and then they'll show a Met opera like on a Sunday. And I think that's kind of a cool way, too, to get someone in and get that immersive experience, even though it's not live. Maybe it's not live. Opera might not be accessible to everybody right away, but you might get hooked and find that you're into it.
Absolutely. One of my favorite memories of one of those is I went, you know, I live here in Bloomington, Indiana, and I went to the movie theater with my then maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 year old son. And one of my dear friends, who he was actually the ring bearer for her wedding, was singing the lead role at the Met, and they were doing this live HD broadcast. And so we texted her, we're like, we're going to go see you at the movies, and we're going to throw popcorn at the screen when you're singing your big aria.
I love it.
And she's like, do it. And so I ended up taking a picture of her, or a video of her singing and us throwing popcorn at her. And it was so fun.
I love that. You're a mezzo soprano. So for someone, you know, for the listeners who aren't singers and have no idea what that means, tell us what that means.
So most of you, like if you sang a choir, you would know that there's sopranos and altos and tenors and basses. In the opera world, a mezzo soprano is the same as what an alto would be in choir. So of the two types of female voices, I have the lower type. I sing oftentimes the harmony and the lower notes to the soprano, who would usually be the leading lady.
So in opera, is there no alto?
There is a voice called contralto, which is actually lower than mezzo soprano.
Okay.
But that's a very, very rare voice type. So yes, mezzo sopranos would be the same as altos usually.
Okay, that's helpful. Well, you mentioned your son. I know you've got 2 kids.
I have 2 kids. I have an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old, both boys, and they are crazy kids running around all the time.
And you have been traveling as an opera singer since they were really little. Is that right?
Yeah. So my oldest son, I actually found out I was pregnant with him about 3 weeks or 2 weeks before I went on the road for my first really big job. So I always say that I've been a mom as long as I've been an opera singer, and they kind of go hand in hand for me.
Yeah. Okay. So what did that look like when they were, you know, babies, toddlers, and you were on the road traveling for work? How did that lifestyle look?
Yeah. So my first gig back post-baby. For my first baby was at when he was 6 weeks old. And I went and sang a concert and he had his first smile in a hotel room. I have video. It comes across my feed every once in a while. And you know, they've kind of been, the first time he went out of the country was when he was 4 months old. We went to London and we were there for a couple months. And so when they were younger, they were always able to travel with me. My mom, who has been my savior, has usually traveled with me as well when we're on the road, and she helps with the kids. And so, you know, I would go to work and she would stay home with my kids, and then I'd come home and make dinner and maybe go to a show in the evening and then come home and make sure I was breastfeeding or whatever I was doing, you know, in the middle of the night, and then wake up and do the same thing the next day. Yeah.
Wow.
So, but, you know, every single town I've ever worked in, I know where the Children's Museum is. I know where the zoo is.
Wow.
I've been to them all.
Yes, I bet. And what a fun, I mean, that's so different, but I'm sure that was stressful in its own way, but also a really cool experience for your kids.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of times opera singers say, oh, we're so lonely on the road because you kind of just stay in a hotel room for, you know, a month at a time when you're on the road. But with me and with my kids on the road with me, I was always able to go out and explore the cities that I was living in and really get an idea of where I was. And it was a great experience.
Well, yeah, because traveling with kids definitely gives you a sense of place in a way that being alone just kind of doesn't. I mean, there's not really a good reason to hang out in playgrounds if you're alone, or, you know, at the Children's Museum or the play place. Yeah. So exactly. What does it look like now that they're older?
Oh, well, the 2019-2020 season, right before the pandemic, was my first season that both kids were in school and I could no longer travel with them, because when I go on the road, it's usually for at minimum a month. Yeah. And so I can't take my kids out of school anymore for that long period of a time. And that first year was amazing because I was like, oh, I could go get a massage, right, or I could, you know, whatever. And then I'll parent from afar via FaceTime. But this year has been, you know, quite different now that we're returning from the pandemic. We basically, our whole art form was shut down for almost 2 years, and everything was closed. And so now that we're kind of back in it, it's been really different. I've been super busy this season, and I kind of was gone from beginning of September till mid-May, only being home for a couple weeks here, a couple weeks there. And so my husband, who is also a musician, he travels as well. And oftentimes our kids are at home with a babysitter for extended periods of time or whatever that looks like. But it's not the easiest way to parent. But then, you know, spring break, they got to come to Washington, D.C. And, you know, they've been to Boston this year and Chicago. And so they do get, you know, to come see me when I'm on the road and see the shows that I'm in. But it definitely is a lot of parenting via FaceTime for me.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, I think one thing that's really cool is that you kind of got that little reprieve or a break, whatever you want to call a pandemic. I mean, it wasn't like you asked for it, but you got to kind of experience what it was like to probably be around your kids all the time. And they got to experience that about you. And then now you've got this totally other situation at an age where at least your oldest is really, they really need a chauffeur at this age, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of driving around. So you can kind of pass that off to someone else.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, actually with my oldest, just because of the way the pandemic worked out and everything, a lot of his stuff, he does music as well. He's a pianist. But his lessons ended up turning into Zoom lessons, and he studies with someone in New York. So for him, everything is, you know, any extracurriculars right now are actually online still, which has been great in the fact that I don't have to provide transportation for him every single week going here and there. And and my youngest is still not quite interested in extracurriculars, but I have a feeling that's coming soon.
Yeah. It definitely shifts into a different, you know, with my older kids, I feel, and my youngest is 13 now, so I'm in a totally different stage. Most of my kids are adults now, but like, there's definitely this stage where you're thinking, I'm really here as like furniture and a set of keys. Like, I'm here to be in the background and like helping, sort of hovering in the background, but I'm not really, they're not looking to me necessarily for like a lot of one-on-one time. And that starts to happen kind of quickly, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I think my 11-year-old, he's like, oh, mommy's gone, so I can play as many video games as I want to or whatever.
Yeah.
But actually, my younger one this morning, kind of joking, but kind of not, said, and I wrote this down because I was like, no truer words have ever been spoken. He says, you don't matter because you're my mommy.
Oh my gosh, like, that should be on a t-shirt for sure.
Right.
Yes. Right. You don't matter because you're my mommy. I love it. And what that really means is that you matter so much. It's like, you know what I mean? You matter
exactly.
so much. You're everything, except that kind of makes you nothing.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Well, let's take a quick break. And when we get back, I want to talk about this documentary that I watched about you and your sort of mission to have more representation and inclusion in opera. This is a really cool story. So we will dive into that when we get back. If there is one thing I wasn't really prepared for in my 40s, it's how much having sore feet can mess with my mojo. Every now and then I experience a bout of plantar fasciitis, and I sometimes get run-of-the-mill foot soreness, which can make everything from getting out of bed in the morning to sitting back on my heels in yoga a real pain, pun totally intended. This episode's sponsor, Vionic, is a footwear brand that helps keep my feet feeling their best. All Vionics feature VioMotion technology, Vionics' patented podiatrist-developed footbed that's built into every style they make. It delivers three-zone comfort with a deep heel cup for stability, ball of foot cushioning, and ultimate arch support for uplifting overall foot contact. And these shoes aren't just ridiculously comfortable, they're also so cute. I have been loving the Clarita wedges lately. They're sort of a retro-inspired stacked heel wedge and honestly the most comfortable wedges I've ever worn. If you struggle with plantar fasciitis or other heel pain, you might be interested to know that Vionic shoes are clinically proven to help. And with Vionic's 30-day wear test, there's no reason not to try them out. You can return your Vionics for a full refund within 30 days if you're not satisfied for any reason, even if you've worn them outside. Enjoy free shipping at VionicShoes.com with promo code MORE, M-O-R. Again, go to V-I-O-N-I-C, VionicShoes.com, and use the code MORE, M-O-R, for free shipping. Okay, back to the interview. Okay, Nina. So I have the pleasure of watching a short documentary that was in Time Magazine's website, and it was called How an Asian American Opera Singer Found Her Voice Amid a Reckoning with Race. So this was really interesting to me because I guess, well, first of all, I think you said in the documentary that you had never really considered yourself. I mean, you'd never really thought about the fact that you were an Asian American opera singer. You were an opera singer who started getting a lot of Asian roles. And then it became clear that maybe you were being typecast and that there was sort of this, not a great deal of diversity in the roles that you were being offered. So tell us a little bit about how that process happened.
Yeah. So growing up in Santa Barbara, California, I was one of very few Asian American people living in our community. And had you asked me, you know, a few years ago, I would have said, well, I identify as a Southern Californian or a wife, a mom, a daughter, but I never have really taken the time to identify myself as quote unquote Asian American. I'm fourth generation Japanese American. My grandparents were incarcerated during World War II. And the, you know, Asian culture after World War II really wasn't handed down in my family. So in 2021, after the shootings of Asian American or Asian women in Atlanta, there was this big outcry in, you know, across the nation, but especially in the arts as well, saying, well, we support our Asian American singers, artists, whatever. And I started to look around and I realized that every single company who was putting up these social media posts was putting up pictures of Asian American singers, opera singers in my case, and all of the pictures showed us typecast into Asian roles. Mm. And I knew I had been typecast, but I never knew how much I had been typecast. And as I went back and I looked at all the roles I've done in the span of 10 years, it turned out that, you know, doing over 150 performances of Suzuki and Madame Butterfly and many other Asian identifying roles in other operas, I had only done three roles that were non-Asian. Wow. And that was just shocking to me, who's only half Asian, that that's what that had become. And as I told a friend this, she said, well, that's pigeonholing, and pigeonholing is a form of racism. And it just kind of opened my eyes to what has been happening in our industry, in an industry that, of course, you know, was founded in Europe and is a very European-centric art form, you know, that has been going for generations, where it's founded on the premises of, you know, white supremacy. And so I started looking around and I was like, okay, we now live in the United States where we are a multicultural society. And why aren't we producing opera, and why aren't our stages looking like the communities we live in? And so I started decided it was time to start advocating for that. For, you know, in the United States in general, there's been a big push towards DEI. And I think opera is one of the slowest moving industries as far as diversity, equity, and inclusion go. And so I said, it's time to go. Let's start speaking up about these inequities.
So I'm not sure how casting works in an opera. I kind of have an understanding about it from the theater world, but is it the kind of thing where your reputation is going on ahead of you and casting decisions are kind of being made before, you know, are you auditioning? Are roles getting assigned to people? Would someone look at your headshot and just think, not for her, and move on to the next headshot? Like, where do you think, at what stages was the discrimination happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think as a younger singer, I would go and I would audition. And I often wonder, you know, Yoshida was my maiden name, and I kept it as kind of a middle name, but I go by Nina Yoshida Nelson. And I wonder, had I taken Yoshida out and just been Nina Nelson, what that would have looked like for me. But yes, they did see my headshot. Yes, I would walk into the room and audition. Now that I've been in the industry longer, people know my name and know, oh, Nina does Suzuki. She's done a lot of Suzukis. Mm. Well, what they don't realize, because I am self-employed, is that I may do Suzuki in, let's say, Atlanta, and then I go and do Suzuki in Chicago or wherever, but Atlanta only knows that I've done Suzuki there. They don't necessarily follow my trajectory and wherever else I do it. And so when I realized this, I was like, well, if opera companies aren't aware of the fact that everybody has been doing this to my career, how can they ever change? And so that's why I really said, okay, it's time to speak out now, because no one is even aware that this is what's happening to these singers' careers.
Wow. Okay. So, and it sounds like there's an issue where you weren't getting those roles, like you weren't getting roles that were outside of sort of that pigeonhole or that box. Is there also the other problem that there just aren't enough Asian American singers who are going into opera? Because I could see how those two things could work together.
Yeah. So, so last spring I founded an organization called the Asian Opera Alliance. And one of the things we're doing right now is we're actually looking at all the demographics of what it looks like in a conservatory or a university, a young artist program, all of these stages of where our preparation happens in order to come into the industry. And yes, there are very few Asian American singers, especially of my age. I'm one of the oldest, and I'm not that old. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot that are coming. But one of the other things we realized when we looked around is none of us have had any role models of what it looks like to even have a successful career as an Asian American singer. So if we don't even have a blueprint to how we can become successful, how will we ever become successful? So, you know, that was the first thing. It's like, okay, we have no role models. One of the first things we need to do is establish a community where we can make sure that we're supporting each other and making sure that we are encouraging each other, especially the younger singers as they come into the industry.
I'm thinking about, you know, roles where it really doesn't matter what race plays the role. And do you feel like those roles... is it like almost like a subconscious thing where a casting, whoever's doing the casting, might look at you and just think and just not think that you are that role for no reason besides your own biases? Yeah.
Absolutely. It is very much the lack of creativity. But I mean, look at Hamilton, for example, right, or Bridgerton, right? And these are art forms that are kind of thinking outside of the box and thinking, does it really matter what ethnicity you are when you're telling these stories? Or have we just made it that way for so long that that's what our implicit biases are? Yeah. And we don't even think outside of the box.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, like you said, those new stories being told in that way where they're sort of ambiguous, like it doesn't matter. Maybe that's a part of the solution too. Is part of the work that you're doing also kind of encouraging those new works that can look at ethnicity and race and just kind of take it off the table as a factor, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the work I'm doing is twofold. It's the first part is let's not just typecast our ethnic singers, our singers of color into those roles that are specifically written for, you know, specific ethnicities. Let's not only do that, but let's also look at making our stages, if we're doing a very traditional opera like La Traviata or Bohème or something like that, let's make sure that our stages look the way that our societies look. So not all of the people up on that stage are white, but mm-hmm. we should have Black singers and, you know, Hispanic singers and Asian singers and a diversity, a rainbow of ethnicities and identities up on those stages.
Yeah. Is the work you're doing getting attention? Do you see a change happening? Changes happening in your career or just in the wider industry?
Yeah, I mean, definitely change is really slow, right? Yeah, in general, it takes time. But yes, I mean, Time Magazine reached out to me and said, oh, Nina, the work you're doing is really important. We'd love to follow you around. And that's, you know, a national, international platform that many opera singers aren't given access to. So I do think that it is, people are noticing. I've been able to consult with many of the opera companies across the United States to talk about these DEI initiatives. And, you know, this season for me, this past season, the 21-22 season, I sang 8 roles, 3 of which were Asian identifying roles, 5 of which were non-Asian identifying roles. So in the span of one season, I almost doubled what I did in the span of 10 years.
Wow.
That being said, you look at next season for me and every single role so far that I have contracts for are all Asian identifying roles.
Okay.
So what we're seeing is a band-aid. We're not seeing actual change yet. And that'll take time.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I bet there's a little bit of conflict too in that, because it's like, well, Suzuki's been pretty good to you. But Suzuki's not all you want. You know, it's like, those flip sides of the same coin.
Exactly. Absolutely. She's been a good friend to me. She's paid lots of bills over right. the years. It's a very, you know, it's not a difficult role to sing. So especially when I was raising my young kids and on the road all the time, I realized that, you know, I could go to the beach all day long and then I could go get in makeup and perform her that night. And it wasn't overly taxing. But now that I'm kind of past that stage mm-hmm. in my life, I'm mm-hmm. also ready to take on these other challenges.
Right.
And so I hope they come my way. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, what does the future hold for you and your family and your career? Your kids are getting into that. I just love the stage your kids are in right now. In that sort of like 5 to 12, 13-year-old stage. It's great. But what do you see? Yeah. What do you see kind of coming down the road for you?
So I was just a few months ago named as the artistic advisor at Boston Lyric Opera. So I'm getting to influence change there,
yeah.
And help diversify that company. It's really great because as a singer, we don't normally have access to the other side, the administrative side of opera. And it's been fascinating for me to see what happens behind the scenes when the singers aren't there and to learn about that. So that's the first thing I'm really excited about is working with Boston Lyric Opera and help move them forward to create the change that's needed in our industry. And then, you know, singing and spending as much time when I'm not on the road with my kids. My 11-year-old is playing a concerto at Carnegie Hall in November. Oh. So luckily, it's like the week after I'm done with performances, and my husband won't be performing that weekend either. So we've like marked everything off on the calendar, and we get to follow him to New York, which will be fun. And it's honestly, it's one day at a time. It's trying to figure out how I do childcare and traveling and, you know, everything else that goes into the mix of being a mother who's on the road all the time.
Yeah. Are there any dream roles that you haven't sung yet that you're still kind of hoping will happen for you?
Yeah, there are a ton. I've never sung Carmen, which like would be obvious. Like, of course, Nina should sing Carmen. Her voice is perfect for it. And then there's a bunch of kind of bigger Verdian roles that I'm excited to dig my teeth into. And yeah, there are some of the bigger, you know, the one big, what we call the big house, the Metropolitan Opera. I've never sung there. So So I do have my eyes set on certain prizes. Absolutely.
I'm curious, too, if, you know, you mentioned that you're not that old, but I think you said you were one of the older. What was it you said? You were one of the older
Asian American singers.
Asian American singers. That's right. I couldn't remember if it was to play a certain role or not.
Yeah.
So what does that look like? Is there, I mean, ageism also to contend with in the opera world in addition to racial biases?
Absolutely. Ageism, sizeism. You know, oftentimes I think people think of an opera singer as being a big fat soprano with the, you know, the horns, wearing the horns.
And yes.
That's not the case anymore, especially with like what you mentioned, the Metropolitan Opera, their HD broadcasts. They want to make sure that the singers look as good as they sound. So there's a lot of stuff to contend with. But I think if you manage your career correctly, there is a trajectory for older singers. It just may not be, you know, the glamour that some of the younger singers experience.
Is there a time when your voice is like in its peak as an opera singer? When would that be?
For me, it's right about now. It's the next 5-10 years. It kind of depends what type of singer you are. You know, I mentioned soprano and mezzo, but there's also within each of those voice types, you have some smaller voice types, some bigger voice types. I have a bigger mezzo soprano voice, so it's taken longer for me to mature into my voice, whereas some of the smaller voices would have been ready to go at age 22. Oh,
okay.
You know, now that I'm 40, I'm like, okay, I am here. I'm ready.
Right.
So
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
And is there another genre of music or another style that you would also like to explore, or is just like opera it for you?
Well, you know, think back to like junior high school for me. And I remember people saying, Nina, you sound like an opera singer, when I was in junior high school. And I was like, what? And I had no clue what that meant. But I think, you know, since I've been, as long as I've been singing, I've sounded like an opera singer. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are able to do lots of different genres. But for me, you know, take me, my husband loves to ask me to karaoke because I sound like an opera singer trying to sing pop music, and it's ridiculous.
I bet that is some fun karaoke to go watch, though. Yeah. I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Nina. I will definitely link up your website and that documentary in the show notes so people can check it out. I think it's just fascinating what you're doing, and best of luck for the next 5 to 10 years, just owning it.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Mother of Reinvention Show. As always, you can find everything we talked about in today's episode at motherofreinventionshow.com, including a link to that documentary featuring Nina and those cute Clarita wedges from our sponsor, Vionic. As always, if you have suggestions or comments about the show, I'd love to hear from you. You can email hello@motherofreinventionshow.com or find me at Mother of Reinvention Show or at Megan Francis, M-E-A-G-A-N Francis, on Instagram. Talk to you soon.